Those of us in academic life know that there are certain nodal points from which a great many of the people who contribute in any discipline seem to derive and emerge. And one of Gadda Smith's great contributions has been that he has influenced a stream of people who have gone on to become leaders. This is the latest, the winner of the Porter Prize, which is the Distinguished Prize in Humanities, Arts, and Sciences at Yale, has just finished a manuscript that some of us are reviewing. And that contribution is, of course, an enormous contribution. So is his work in an ancillary field, American maritime history, but that's of course one in which only a few of you around the table are qualified enough to evaluate the subject. Those of us in international relations tend to be ignoramuses in some areas such as that. But all of us have benefited enormously from his contributions in the field of diplomatic history. On our subject today, he has written the book Morality, Reason, and Power, which we go back to in thinking about the Carter presidency, not only because of its reporting of what happened, but also because of its framing of the issues in terms of a coherent set of ideas against which the Carter presidency is judged. He wrote an earlier book on Dean Acheson as Secretary of State, and a history of wartime diplomatic relations. In the tradition of his mentor, Samuel Flagg Bemis, who was one of the earlier great figures in the field of diplomatic history. Gadda Smith was born in New Jersey, had both his undergraduate and graduate degrees at Yale, taught for 3 years at Duke University, came back to Yale and has been there since, has been chairman of the history department, has been master of Pearson College, but fortunately for all of us who are some distance from Yale, he has, both in his writings and his students, greatly illuminated our understanding of the field of diplomatic history. So it's a great pleasure to have you with us, and we look forward to a discussion of President Carter's rhetoric.
All right, thank you, Professor Thompson. It is indeed a pleasure to be here on, I know it's just a normal day, you have it every day like this, here in Charlottesville. It's lovely. When Professor Thompson asked me to discuss Jimmy Carter's rhetoric with you, I was delighted to accept, but rhetoric as such is not a subject that I have focused on directly. I've seen it as an essential part of government, but I do not pretend to be an authority in a technical sense on rhetoric. I'd like to start by giving you my working description of what it means to study president's rhetoric, and then describe some standards that we might apply to rhetoric before going into Jimmy Carter's rhetoric itself. Rhetoric, in its broadest meaning, is the use of words in discourse. That's too broad for our purposes, and I propose that Carter's public use of words, delivered orally in person, while he was president, to use to define the texts that we will study. Now, this might be a bit arbitrary. There certainly was a good deal of use of rhetoric in private, dealing with, say, with the National Security Council, or dealing in secret sessions with foreign ministers, but we don't have the transcripts yet for that use of rhetoric. And there also is rhetoric in private written communications, but again, the vast bulk of President Carter's papers are not yet open for historians. We also have secondhand reports of what Carter said in situations where his words, in fact, were not recorded, but they are problematic, and I'm going to exclude those. We also have purely written texts, like annual budget messages, which go on sometimes for hundreds of pages. They weren't written by the president, and we can exclude them. We also could, for convenience sake, exclude texts prepared before he was president, the campaign speeches of 1976, for example, or things written since he was president, his memoirs and his several other books. Now, there's the problem of authorship, and this is a problem for anyone studying the president. We all know that presidents have large staffs of speechwriters, and that their public statements are often an amalgam of material presented by different cabinets and agencies and departments, and then worked over by the speechwriters. It is possible, when all of the archives are open, to trace out exactly which sentence, which paragraph came where, and note exactly how it was changed by speechwriters and then by the president. But we don't have full access to that material. It's an enormous task to reconstruct that kind of literary history of every speech. I haven't done it. So for the purposes of my remarks, I'm going to assume that if Jimmy Carter said it personally, the words came out of his mouth, that's his rhetoric. He chose to say those words, even though they may literally have been written in many cases by other people. Indeed, if we excluded from the study of presidential rhetoric every word, every sentence that was produced by somebody else, we would have Swiss cheese that was all whole and no cheese. And the source of the material that I'm using for my remarks are the familiar volumes of the public papers of the president for Jimmy Carter. They are green and blue, and they are on the shelf in that room to my left. And everyone who deals with American presidencies in recent years, the 20th century, knows those invaluable volumes. Now, what is it that we want to study about the rhetoric? Now, that's a much more complex question than simply what are the texts for the rhetoric. We certainly do not want to engage in purely literary analysis, like graduate students in literature trying to find something new to say about Shakespeare. We don't want to come up with Carter's use of the conjunction in State of the Union addresses, or gastronomical metaphors in the press conference. We are concerned with rhetoric as part of political persuasion. The best modern book on rhetoric is by Brooks and Warren, and the title is Modern Rhetoric. And they say that there are four elements to rhetoric. Argument, attempts to persuade people. Exposition, attempts to explain and inform. Description, attempts to make the listener or the reader see and feel a situation. And narration, to show what happened and why. And for our case, the first element, argument, is preeminent, because that's what political rhetoric is about. Political rhetoric uses the other elements, exposition, description, narration, but they are servants to the principal purpose of argument. Now, what standard
of judgment should we apply to Carter's rhetoric as argument. We cannot divorce ourselves from the larger political context and from the degree to which the president's goals were achieved or not. But we don't want to maintain the position that good rhetoric is that which works, and rhetoric which doesn't work is bad rhetoric. And that's rather reductionist, because we know that there are so many other factors that will determine whether a bill passes or a treaty is confirmed, or the Democratic Party wins or loses an election. There's so many other factors at work that rhetoric has got to be only one element. An additional complexity flows from the many different audiences which a president especially seeks to influence. To take a non-presidential and rather simple example, if Newt Rockne in the locker room before the big game exhorts the team to win one for the Gipper, and the team goes out and does that, wins, that's a pretty simple case. Now, we know what the rhetoric was, we know what the audience was, it was the team, there wasn't any other audience at the time. We know the purpose, and the outcome is easy. We can determine it quantitatively by the final score. But how many different audiences and purposes are there for a president, for a State of the Union address? Or take, in Carter's case particularly, the State of the Union address in January 1980, which dealt with the hostage crisis in Iran, but even more with the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Layers and layers of audience, both domestic and international. And we, as historians, are part of the audience. And especially dealing with someone as recent as Jimmy Carter, I think everyone in this audience now was an adult during the Carter administration. We were original. We were part of the original audience, as well as now part of the historical audience. And we have our own values and our prejudices. We reacted at the time to what Carter says. And if we're now trying to be historians, the memory of how we reacted will affect our judgment. And our memory, in fact, may not be accurate. But still, what we think we remember affects what we think now. And on that point, let me confess my own bias, because we all have biases. I respected and admired Jimmy Carter's integrity and his goals when he was president. I respect and admire the way he has comported himself since his retirement from the White House. But I cannot call him an effective president. Much of his difficulty was bad luck, due to circumstances beyond his control, but much of it can also be attributed to his own failings, including failings of rhetoric. My judgment on his rhetoric is harsh, I think, as you will hear in a moment, but it's also sad, because I think the rhetoric was being employed in a good cause. My judgment is also quite subjective. It draws on my own taste in rhetorical techniques and my own sense of the context of what Carter was trying to achieve, and my own comparisons to the rhetoric of other presidents. A moment ago, I dismissed the usefulness of any purely literary analysis. But literary analysis, in the sense of how words are used, must be employed to some degree. Now, two disclaimers. I have not interviewed Mr. Carter or any of his aides. I've not talked to Mr. Carter at all, nor have I talked to aides about the subject of rhetoric. And I cannot say how much of the rhetorical style was deliberate, calculated, and how much of it was inadvertent. And the other disclaimer is that being a neophyte in the subject of formal subject of rhetoric, I've not searched the professional journals of speech and communication. My hunch is that there probably is already a literature by the professional study students of rhetoric and the communication arts of Carter's rhetoric, and maybe even a doctoral dissertation or two. But I haven't read that that material, and perhaps I will at some point, but I haven't done it yet. Now, Jimmy Carter was a talking president. He spoke on an extraordinary number of occasions. There were news conferences twice a week in the first 2 years of the presidency. After mid-1979, however, as crises mounted, both domestic and international, he reduced the number of news conferences. But there were call-in shows. You could dial an 800 number, and you had a 1 in a million chance. You could actually put a question over the telephone to Jimmy Carter. There were town meetings throughout the United States and abroad. One of the most interesting ones that I've come upon was in Shimoda, Japan. There were informal question and answer sessions with all manner of groups. And I haven't made a quantitative comparison, but I suspect Jimmy Carter may have had more of his words, spoken words, recorded in the 4 years that he was president than any other president in our history. And there certainly wasn't any of this stuff over the clatter of the helicopter with Jimmy Carter. Another general remark, though, is that there's a sameness to his rhetoric. He doesn't seem to alter the way he speaks, the way he uses words to meet the audience or the circumstances. He spoke as if the audience for Jimmy Carter was Jimmy Carter. And I'm going to emphasize this theme. There's a very personal quality to it, this constant reference back to his own life, his own experience. Whether this is deliberate or self-conscious, I do not know. Now, he was not a widely read or traveled man. And his illustrations, his references, his comparisons are drawn very largely from his own life. Now, here's a question I'm going to put to this audience. Who was the first person mentioned by name by President Jimmy Carter within seconds of his taking the oath for president? Anyone know? Ken knows, but I won't let him answer.
Wasn't it his daughter?
No. Julia Coleman. Julia Coleman was his high school teacher of English. And he refers to her in the very beginning of his inaugural address as someone who had a great impact on his life and in teaching him spiritual values. Now, of course, in his conduct of the presidency, he has to mention thousands of individuals. He presents people, nominates people for office, cabinet members. He has to refer to congressmen, senators, foreign leaders, his staff, his family. But I'm struck with how few individuals, except those that he has to mention in a sort of business way, are quoted or mentioned in the whole body of his rhetoric. There are a few biblical figures and biblical quotations. There's Martin Luther King, there's Reinhold Niebuhr, there's Paul Tillich, another theologian. Other presidents rather rarely. Sometimes he uses rhetoric which is reminiscent of other presidents, especially Woodrow Wilson, but very seldom does he mention Wilson by name. And there is indeed a thinness, a poverty of historical and literary references in his discourse. Now, perhaps his emphasis on himself was calculated as part of an effort to present himself as a president of the people, drawing strength and wisdom from the people, other people just like me, demonstrating that in America, any person, no matter how obscure a background, could become president. And that's a paraphrase of a remark that he made often about himself. But I sense that it was more than deliberate calculation, that it reflected a fundamental loneliness in the man, an introversion, an uneasiness in applying the experience of others with which he was not intimately connected to the role of government. And I believe he was speaking truthfully when he told a group in 1979 that his rural childhood near Plains, Georgia, had been the happiest time of his life, and, quote, "When I'm now in the White House, in Washington, my greatest hunger is to be alone, away from security, away from the press, and to be in the fields and woods again." As a teacher and advisor to students, I know, and I think others who are teachers in this audience know, that we constantly harp on the importance of the lead paragraph in any text when dealing with our students, and the importance of the lead sentence within each paragraph. Whether it's a newspaper story or a State of the Union address or an inaugural or whatever it is, it's that first sentence and that first paragraph that's going to have the biggest impact. And I find it extraordinary how many of Carter's leads refer to himself directly or implicitly. There's the reference to Julia Coleman and her impact on himself, the very beginning of his inaugural. There's the famous spiritual crisis speech of 1979, known as the malaise speech, although he did not, in fact, use the word malaise in that speech. And that speech begins with these words: "This is a special night for me. Exactly 3 years ago, on July 15, 1976, I accepted the nomination of my party to run for President of the United States." One can be cynical. Who cared that it was exactly 3 years? And why begin the speech with that, which was certainly one of the most important speeches, he thought, in his whole life? There's the implicit self-reference in the opening sentence of the 1980 State of the Union address, another very important address, the one on Iran and Afghanistan. Quote, "These last few months have not been an easy time for any of us." It refers to himself. The us is almost the royal we, I think, in that circumstance. The spiritual crisis speech is one of the most interesting of all of Carter's statements. The particular substantive problem in that summer of 1979 was the energy crisis. And Carter tied that crisis to his most oft-repeated idea that the fundamental issue was the spiritual health of the people. At the beginning of his presidency, he carried on with a theme that had been very important in his campaign, and that was that the spiritual health of the American people was rock solid. He had enormous confidence in it. He was drawing his own strength from it. He promised a government as good as the people. But there was also a contradictory claim at the same time, and that is that Watergate and Vietnam indicated that there was a lack of spiritual health, and that now somehow there would be a rebirth, and he would lead it. And now, just 2 years after his inauguration, in 1979, he spoke grimly of, quote, "a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives. and in the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. The erosion of our confidence in the future is threatening to destroy the social and political fabric of America. Now, you will recall, I'm sure, the immediate circumstances of that speech. He originally had intended to address the nation on the energy problem early in July, but his speech was canceled at the last minute, and he retreated to Camp David, and for 10 days invited, in his own words, people from every segment of society, business and labor, teachers and preachers, governors, mayors, and private citizens, to come visit him at Camp David and tell him what was wrong. And he filled a huge notebook in his own handwriting with their comments. And he quoted quite a bit of this in his speech, and I'll just give you a sampling. These are quotes of other people. "You don't see the people enough anymore. Some of your cabinet members don't seem loyal. I feel so far from government. I feel like ordinary people are excluded from political power. Mr. President, we are confronted with a moral and spiritual crisis." Now, I'd be interested to hear how any of you reacted to that speech, and I'm nearing the end here, and let's end the discussion. Hear some of that reaction. I recall that I myself did not feel that this alleged spiritual crisis was within me. I didn't feel a spiritual crisis. Nor did I sense it was really widespread throughout the nation. Instead, I interpreted the speech as self-revelation, that Carter was talking much more about himself than about any objective reality in the nation. And I feared that Carter was undergoing a crisis. And it did not enhance my own confidence in him at the time. Now, this brings me to the question of what it is, what quality is, which inspires confidence in a president's audience, constituents. I've been searching for a single word, and I've come up with serenity, although I'd have some problems with that word, but I'm going to use serenity. Serenity is a sort of a Pennsylvania Avenue version of the right stuff. In his fireside chat on February 2nd, 1977, that's his first fireside chat, Carter said, quote, "I have spent a lot of time deciding how I can be a good president." I think that was probably true, but it was bad rhetoric. Someone once said that FDR never had to think about what it meant to be president. He was president. And most important, he was serene in his own identity. One sensed that no matter how serious the crisis, the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the terrible economic crisis of the Great Depression, that FDR's own personal stability was not risk. And this calm quality that I have in mind is not the same as passivity by any means, because serenity can be the companion of enormous activity and energy and commitment. And thinking of 20th century presidents, I would say that Theodore Roosevelt had it, as well as Franklin Roosevelt. Wilson had it through 1918 and then lost it very emphatically. Eisenhower had it. So did Kennedy. Lyndon Johnson had it some of the time. Hoover lacked it. So did Nixon. Ford, Harding, Coolidge, Truman, I would rank somewhat neutral on this. Reagan had it. Whatever you think of Reagan, he had serenity. It's too early to tell about Bush, and Carter was, alas, quite without it. I and virtually everyone who has written on the foreign policy of the Carter administration have commented on its schizophrenic nature, torn between Secretary of State Vance's efforts to solve conflict through negotiation, Zbigniew Brzezinski's passion to change Soviet behavior by threat, intimidation, and the infliction of pain, and Carter's own moral sense. Both Vance and Brzezinski had different approaches, and they both appear in Carter's speeches. And this is, I think, the problem of the speech writing way in which speeches are put together. Sometimes these conflicts appear in the same speech. Carter's failure to recognize the tension in these two approaches at times led to an awkwardness that bordered on incoherence. I'm not saying that he should have opted entirely for one or the other, because the tension is there, it's real, but I think it has to be confronted and explained. The confusion in policy and the confusion in rhetoric were much the same thing. They found expression in Carter's shifting invocation of historical meaning, rare though the invocation of history was. And it also found expression in his unfortunate penchant for exaggeration, which is a characteristic of his rhetoric. In his Notre Dame speech of May 1977, which came closer, I think, than any other early statement to expressing his personal vision of a better world, Carter made the famous declaration that, quote, being confident of our own future, we are now free of that inordinate fear of communism which once led us to embrace any dictator who joined us in that fear. For too many years, we've been willing to adopt the flawed and erroneous principles of our adversaries, sometimes abandoning our own values for theirs. This approach failed, with Vietnam the best example of its intellectual and moral poverty. It's very, very interesting passage. 2.5 years later, the Soviets intervened in Afghanistan, and Carter indulged in great exaggeration. He called that event the greatest threat to world peace since the Second World War. And then he described its relationship to history in a way that was completely different from his reading of history back in the Notre Dame speech. He said, since the end of the Second World War, America led other nations in meeting the challenge of Soviet power. In the 1940s, we took the lead in creating the Atlantic Alliance in response to the Soviet suppression and consolidation of its East European empire. In the 1950s, we helped to contain further the Soviet challenge in Korea and the Middle East. In the 1960s, we met the Soviet challenges in Berlin, and we faced the Cuban Missile Crisis, and so on. No mention of Vietnam. No mention of moral and intellectual poverty. Now, I think both interpretations of history have some validity, and a president with a greater historical sense could have shown how they were interrelated. But Carter, with his penchant for hyperbole and exaggeration and oversimplification, seemed to throw out one interpretation without any trace whatsoever to embrace another. Now let me end on a more sympathetic note. I see Jimmy Carter as someone who tried simultaneously to think out and to act, to think and to act in several different realms. He was most comfortable in the lonesome, somewhat introverted role of the boy growing up near plains, wandering in the woods and the fields. He was also comfortable with a small circle of friends and family from Georgia. He was definitely uncomfortable at the level of national politics. He, like Ronald Reagan, campaigned against Washington, something alien to true American character, but when Ronald Reagan got to Washington, he gloried in it. He triumphed. He really loved the place. He may have continued to engage in anti-Washington rhetoric, but he was really in his element. But Carter hated Washington, and he hated it even more at the end than at the beginning of his presidency, and that shows in his rhetoric. And the third realm was the universal world. of all mankind and of the human spirit. And Carter tried to be most truly American by seeing himself and the nation in service to all mankind, not just to the narrow interest of one nation. And here he's the most Wilsonian of presidents. And this vision and the tension between the worldview and the national view is eloquently expressed in the farewell address, Jimmy Carter's farewell address, which is the favorite of all his texts, from my favorite. He simultaneously reaffirmed the necessity of maintaining American armed strength while eloquently describing the consequences of nuclear war and the threat of environmental disaster. Quote, "We see our Earth as it really is, a small and fragile and beautiful blue globe, the only home we have." I think that echoes both planes and the whole world. "We see no barriers of race or religion or country." Of course, the reality is the barriers were everywhere, but this is his vision. "We see the essential unity of our species and our planet, and with faith and common sense, that bright vision will ultimately prevail." Now that, I think, is Jimmy Carter at his best, both in rhetoric and in thought. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Who would like to begin our discussion?
I got a question. Mm-hmm. Do you think, sir, that his failed rhetoric accounts for his incredibly low popularity rating with the American people, 37% against Reagan, 67%?
Well, it's certainly a large part of it.
He never sold himself to the American
people. No, he, especially in that spiritual crisis speech, he attacked the American people. He basically said the problem here is that you're sick spiritually. We have this spiritual crisis. And that wasn't the problem. The problem was the Middle East, OPEC, and some difficulties we had in the distribution of oil. Jimmy Carter's gloominess certainly contributed to his own unpopularity. He also had a lot of very bad luck and bad timing.
I was interested in popularity rating. Not only was he very low among the American people, but the American Bar Association ran a popularity rating among the lawyers. It was just about as bad as the American people.
Yeah, and as I said at the beginning, I admire him as a person, and I admire his goals, but I have to rate him pretty low in terms of effectiveness.
Next question. Yes, Mrs. Yerkes.
If it hadn't been for the hostage crisis and the oil crisis, that his rhetoric would be viewed differently if he had been more successful?
Well, I think here's where you have circumstances, in part that were beyond his control. You also have, and I think this is the most important external factor of all, the Soviets. And the Soviets were in a period of incredibly bad leadership, which Gorbachev and almost everybody else now in the Soviet Union is recognizing. And Brezhnev is becoming one of the dirtiest words in the Soviet rhetorical vocabulary today. This was the period when the Soviet Union was led by a succession of zombies. Now, people who were quite literally on the edge of death. There was paralysis, rigidity, of the worst sort, leading to incredible Soviet blunders, both domestically and in foreign policy. The worst blunder of all was the invasion of Afghanistan, which seemed to undermine what little there was left of the more kind of positive view that Jimmy Carter had about possibilities of international relations. And we can speculate about might have been history. If Gorbachev somehow had come to power in Moscow at the same time that Jimmy Carter had come to power in Washington, my My guess is Jimmy Carter would have been reelected, and things would have been quite different. The hostage crisis in Iran was the end product of 30 years of American-Iranian relationship. It cannot be blamed on Carter himself, the fact that it happened. There is a lot of speculation as to whether he could have handled it more differently. Carter believed, and I think this is part of his moral code, that the most important issue once the hostages were taken was their lives. And he would do everything possible to preserve their lives. Now, some of his advisors said, no, Mr. President, there is a national interest that transcends their lives, and we basically have to affirm our strength and act quickly and immediately. Zbigniew Brzezinski, a national security advisor, wanted the United States to take armed force very quickly, within a few days of the taking of the hostages. It might well have killed the hostages, and Jimmy Carter might have come out with little more damage than Ronald Reagan did from the death of 243 Marines in the barracks in Beirut. But Jimmy Carter refrained from that. He did then authorize the attempted rescue, which failed very early on, long before the team got anywhere close to Tehran. And in the end, within minutes after the beginning of the Reagan administration, we all remember that the hostages were released and no lives were lost. But certainly that was a dark cloud that hung over the last year plus of his presidency.
Next question. Yes, Matt.
Did he actually legally change his name from James to Jimmy?
I don't know. He signs all his presidential papers Jimmy Carter rather than James Earl Carter. I don't know if we have any lawyers in the room. I was born George Gaddis Smith, but I never used the George, so yeah, I've revealed a secret that I'm George. I've never legally changed it. I don't know the answer to that.
Well, Kennedy never changed his name to Jack or Nixon.
Yeah, but Kennedy did sign his state papers, John F. Kennedy.
Yeah, and it always seemed to me that Carter adopted the Jimmy to try to be sort of a good guy, which
I think that is part of the culture that he felt he wanted. But I think he was certainly Jimmy when he was governor, mm-hmm. and I suspect he was. I don't know when he began to be generally called Jimmy, whether he was Lieutenant Commander Jimmy Carter or not. I don't know.
didn't the Camp David Accords give him a great deal of
satisfaction,
mm-hmm. and also elevate his image to the American people?
I think they did. He had substantial achievements in foreign affairs. One which I think was an achievement, which in fact hurt him politically, with the Panama Canal treaties. He narrowly got them through the Senate, and public opinion polls pretty consistent that the majority of the American people were against them.
And look at it now.
And now we've got problems. But I still think it was better to do those treaties than not. Camp David was an achievement. It wasn't a panacea, which we certainly know now. It ended the formal state of war between Egypt and Israel, and led to the withdrawal of Israel from the Sinai, but it did not lead to the Palestinian autonomy in the occupied areas, which was envisioned in the Camp David Accords. I think Mr. Carter was suckered by the Israeli government on that one. He had much higher expectations than the reality of Israeli policy warranted on that. How much that contributed to his popularity ratings in the polls, it's hard to measure. It certainly wasn't enough to get him reelected. he got, in fact, he wasn't all that popular at any point with the organized American Jewish lobby. Some of them were more hard line than the Camp David Accords. So,
excuse me for asking another question, but did he rely upon Madison Avenue for his presentation?
No.
To what extent do you think that his delivery had an effect upon the message that he was trying to get?
Well, he consciously tried to avoid the trappings of the imperial presidency. He wanted to speak in ordinary, almost conversational tones, people to people. I see why he wanted to do that. I kind of respect him for it. I think it's a mistake for a president. I think in a presidential setting, especially kind of major policy addresses, you in fact have got to be a little bit more ceremonial than he was in his style. So I think it's almost on a kind of subjective level. My hunch is that a lot of people said, well, this guy really isn't such a leader. I mean, he's just kind of ordinary guy, and we want someone with more oomph in delivery style.
Yes, George, I have several questions. Awful sort of way to ask it. Various questions bearing on the interweave of piety, his piety, and rhetoric. Despite something from Bill Miller, I think a lot of us thought that when Carter reached the White House, that piety along the Potomac would become a in thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it really didn't. It really didn't work out that way. I'm interested in several aspects of it. One, first a comment, or perhaps that's a second comment. And that is that the self-referencing character of so much of his discourse intimately related to the quality of his piety.
That's it.
The kind of pietism in which he to which he was exposed and which clearly influenced him, and thereafter so much else of his public discourse was self-referencing. Now, finally, I'll get around to a question if you hang in there long enough. May not be worth it, but we'll open all that until we get there, if we get there. I wonder if you're suggesting that this is not a leading question in the jurisprudential sense of the term, that there is indeed a schizophrenic element here in this piety. On the one hand, see, we get the insistence on the importance of salvation, whatever the secular value of that might be. But on the other, we get this scolding of what the preachers would have called sin, see, moral crisis, etc., etc. But you see any point at which his rhetoric, I'll come back to your question of rhetoric, is in fact significantly loaded with biblical imagery, et cetera, et cetera, that some of us would have expected. Not even the vision does not seem to be either the vision of the Old Testament prophets. It's certainly not the vision of Reinhold Niebuhr, whatever that have been.
No.
You see, any point at which his rhetoric was decisively influenced by what he himself took to be his very deep Christian convictions.
Well, you, of course, are a scholar of religious thought, and I'm not, so I'm a little bit out of my depth here. It's interesting that in his go back to my book here, in his inaugural address, after
introducing Julia Coleman, he did make a explicit biblical reference. And he debated over whether, if I can find it, to book sometimes.
when other people put papers.
Yeah. he wanted to use the passage, and you can tell me where she's from, about the people must humble themselves and confess their sins. And he had that in the first draft. And his advisors said to him, this is going to sound as if you are acting as God, and they've got to confess their sins to you, and don't use it. So instead he used the passage from Micah about walk humbly and love mercy. And so but he was ready with the other...
maybe he really all his life. Maybe he really wanted to be a Southern Baptist preacher.
This is from Chronicles. The passage that he wanted to use was, "If my people, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land." Then I say, but at the urging of aides who claim some listeners might think Carter was equating himself with Solomon, these are actually Solomon's words, and condemning all Americans as wicked, he chose instead Micah 6:8. The message was similar, although muted. What doth the Lord require of thee but to do justly, love mercy, and walk humbly with thy God? There are relatively few other explicit biblical references thereafter.
Since your name has been taken in vain, Professor
Miller. Well, I've been sitting here. Thank you. This is a very instructive discussion. I think Jimmy Carter did not want to be a Southern Baptist preacher, but isn't get to the core as much as that he was an engineer. It was... Rickover, rhetoric. You can go back to older and wider and better definitions than you get from the English department. That Brooks and Warren is a composition book that just borrows the word rhetoric. And what you did with it is what you wanted with it. That is to say, you ask, what is the relationship to an audience? The old definitions all have. Speech, audience. Mm-hmm. The key thing to define it is there's an audience, mm-hmm. there's a sense of audience. We had the best and the worst, this is a response to your speech, mm-hmm. the best and the worst rhetoricians in the modern, in what is forced upon us is the modern sense of rhetoric, riding down Pennsylvania Avenue together in January of 1980. Mm-hmm. The Carter really was all thumbs, rhetorically speaking, in the South. Southern Baptists and preachers are not that. They mm-hmm. are, they do have a sense of audience. It's all,
Or like Martin Luther King.
Martin Luther King and a thousand Southern
Jesse
preachers.
Jackson.
And Jimmy Carter did not have that. He did not have a sense of audience, mm-hmm. either in the old sense or where it was an immediate face-to-face audience in a congregation or in a political hall, or in the modern sense where Ronald Reagan has it, where he knows there's a camera and he knows there's a mic. Mm-hmm. There's a great audience out there, and he knows how to play to it. Carter had neither of those, and I think what you sort of have said here today is not really a core of his faith. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask about the Panama Canal, but that would extend the question too much, and you've already mentioned it. Well, before you mentioned it, mm-hmm. there are books about Carter's rhetoric, and, mm-hmm. and the only one I could think of sitting here scrambling in my mind was that there is one defining rhetoric in this very spacious modern way. Don't just think of speeches and what's in speeches and what appeals people use, but think of the whole context of persuasion. Mm. And I guess that gets bigger as the apparatus gets bigger.
Right, and it includes the nonverbal imagery such as walking on Inauguration Day. Right.
Well, and then this, the man who wrote a book about the Panama Canal going back to Teddy Roosevelt and all the way up to Carter.
Laura Fever's book? Or
no, it's called Hogan.
Yeah, okay, great. Yeah, right.
Presents the Panama Canal as a kind of rhetorical, in the sense he's going to use the word, victory. I mean, he did accomplish something important. Most people would call it, you know, political, in getting the treaties through. Mm-hmm. And in a narrower sense, it's a problem in rhetoric, going back to the beginnings, is this mere technique where you don't have any questions about how you use it, just does it work? Or is there some question about, if you're going to say good rhetoric, is there some question about what it's used for? And that's a problem for it, going not only modern, but it goes back to the Jordan. You might say, well, old Carter, he wasn't any good at it, and he was all thumbs, and here was something he cared about. He did persuade in a difficult situation, persuade the country to do something, but went against its drilling teeth to get it.
So, reach out to Vox Populi now, having heard from Vox Theologica.
Yeah. Or any other questions in the other room there?
The other room? No.
Yes, Bill Wimple.
I was struck by, of course, the terrible bad luck that President Carter had. But also, I think it's an interesting speculation as to how he would have done had he been in the White House in Franklin Roosevelt's first two terms. I leave out the war. Mm. Mm. Roosevelt had the best luck you could imagine. He had the bad guys, the pirates of privilege, and he made the most of it.
Yeah.
And he got people cheering, and he got the votes. And I wonder if Carter, with his religious bent or convictions, might have fumbled that.
Well, he'd not done
a Franklin Roosevelt job.
I don't think he would have done a Franklin Roosevelt job. Herbert Hoover hadn't been doing very well up to the time he left office and confronting the crisis. Roosevelt was a master politician in so many ways. He worked magnificently with Congress. He knew how to flatter and win the support of members of Congress. Of course, the nation was united in the sense of crisis. There was perhaps 90% of the people would agree that extraordinary measures must be taken. It's a matter of national life and death now in 1933. Jimmy Carter never had that. But Jimmy Carter's handling of Congress was incredibly inept. In spite of the case of winning the narrowest of margins the necessary Senate votes on the Panama Canal.
Roosevelt had the villains.
Oh, he had wonderful villains to play to. Certainly do.
Other questions?
Yes, Arthur Stocker and then Bill Harbury.
How much, if any, of the contrast between Mr. Reagan's superior rhetoric and Carter's ineffective rhetoric do you think came out in the presidential debates in 1980?
Well, I was biased against Reagan personally. in those debates, and I must say my reaction, I have to confess, was rather elitist one. The American people, are they so dumb that they're going to be fooled by Reagan? I wasn't for Reagan. I thought Jimmy handled himself pretty well in those debates.
he handled himself quite well in the 76 debates against and scored a pretty good point against Jerry Ford on the question of whether Poland was a free nation or not. And I'm not being a professional student of rhetoric, I am still puzzled, frankly, as to the enormous appeal that Ronald Reagan has to so many people. It's almost as if kind of the visceral feeling that people have, this is somebody I like. This is somebody I'd like to have in my living room. Or sitting in the car as we drive down the highway to get is more important than everything else. Not much of an answer.
Mel Barkley?
It seems the malaise factor preceded Carter to the White House. The transition team, those of us who experienced the transition team, felt that...
Where were you in the transition team?
Well, I was at Foreign Agricultural Service. And we were made to feel guilty about everything from the
Were you a career or were you on a transition team?
No, I was career.
Okay, right.
They made us feel guilty from everything from the parking space to the amount of gasoline that our cars used. I never went through such a grilling as those people put on. So how he managed to get these people around himself, or whether he attracted that type of person, but because he himself wasn't doing it personally, but I suspect that was.
But his his close advisors were from a very, very narrow circle, overwhelmingly from the one state of Georgia, and I think you're quite right. This guilt trip they were trying to make a lot of us feel wasn't very effective politics, and poor old Jerry Ford was in a unique and difficult, almost impossible situation. That having pardoned Richard Nixon, he could not free himself of the taint of the Nixon presidency, and that made for a not to be repeated situation. Really extraordinary. Carter had bad luck, but he also had unbelievable luck in getting elected because of the circumstances.
Very narrow.
Yeah.
Any other? Howard Cromwell.
Can you see any relation between Hoover and Carter's background, both being engineers, and how it might have affected?
A superficial relationship. Hoover's world experience, of course, was incredible. He had been operating before the presidency for two decades at kind of the highest level of affairs, running the Belgian relief and the European relief during the First World War, being a major world figure in international mining before 1914, and then, of course, arguably, I think, the most important member of the Coolidge, the Harding Coolidge years in the cabinet. So just in level of experience, enormous. Hoover was a much more, I would say, authoritarian person. Hoover had never been in the military, and even though he was a Quaker, I would say he had characteristics that we often associate with military command. He commanded things to be done. And when the circumstances responded to his commands, he was marvelous. When they no longer responded to his commands with the collapse of the world economy, he was in a pitiful condition, because he didn't have political skills. He had command skills. So I think my basic answer is no. The similarities are too superficial, or perceived too far. Yeah.
Well, I think one
If I might ask this one question, whom did Carter like? Whom did Carter feel at home with? How
well, in the in the. the relationship between Jimmy and Rosalind Carter is a very very important one, and
incidentally, Rosalind Carter will be here on February 21st to discuss the First Lady.
Ken reminded me that I say in the book, and it's something I still hold to, that Rosalind Carter is the most politically aware, astute, intelligent First Lady since Eleanor Roosevelt. Still hold to that. In the realm of foreign leaders, he had good relations with some third world leaders, and the closest relationship he had was with Sadat of Egypt, and surprisingly good relationship with Torrijos of Panama, who was a questionable character, but Carter really liked him. He had very poor relations with and did not like major European figures, Helmut Schmidt being the most notable example, and Schmidt didn't make it easier by publicly calling Carter incompetent. he had difficulty dealing with people who considered themselves his equal. Maybe a lot of us have that problem. I don't think I do. Maybe other people do, but I think he did. Yeah. Right. Well, thank you.